All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. Our guest today, our first guest, is Nebojsa Malik, and oh man, I hope I pronounced that right. He writes the Balkan Express column on antiwar.com, and he's going to come on today and teach us a little bit about what's going on in the former Yugoslavia and so forth. So welcome to the show, Mr. Malik.
Thank you, Philip, thank you. I hope I can do what you expect me to do.
Oh, I don't think it should be too hard. Now, let's see, you've been writing the Balkan Express column on antiwar.com for how long?
3 years now. 3 years this November.
Okay, and now, were you living there during the breakup of Yugoslavia, or were you already living here?
Actually, I lived there until the January of 96, when I came to the States. So I've lived through the Bosnian War, and my hometown is Sarajevo, Bosnia. And that's where I spent the entire time of the Bosnian War. So I was sort of after a fashion witness to events, and also a very much a moving target for about 3 years.
Oh, very much a moving target.
Right, because, you know, people who didn't carry guns were classified as targets.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I would have thought that carrying the gun might have made you the target, no?
Well, actually, most of the casualties in the Bosnian War were civilians who got caught in the sites behind the front lines, because the militaries, it was very much World War One fought with World War Three weapons. So paradoxically enough, unless there was a major sort of offensive in which people would go over the top in the old-fashioned kind of way and come back in the same old-fashioned kind of way in body bags, you were pretty safe if you're on the front line. But if you're a civilian in an area that's immediately near the front line, such as Sarajevo was, you're kind of screwed.
Wow, yeah. And we know that America and NATO and the United Nations ended up intervening over there because of what a mess it was. I guess I shouldn't go ascribing their motives to them yet. We'll wait for that. But maybe you can give us like a brief little refresher course on the breakup of Yugoslavia and the differences between Bosnia and Croatia and Serbia and all the different factions and who was killing who and who started it and who were the good guys and who were the bad guys and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, I can try. First of all, I would probably not talk in terms of good guys and bad guys because, truth be told, everybody was just kind of running rampant around there and killing people and destroying homes and towns and cities and expelling rival populations in the best tradition of basically political Stalinism. See, what happened is that in about 100 years ago, and I'll try to be very, very brief, about 100 years ago, right around World War One, Serbia, which was an independent kingdom at the time, had successfully defeated, with quite a bit of help from Britain and France, the Austrians, Germans, and Bulgarians who had occupied the Balkans at the time. And as Serbian and British and French troops were advancing towards Vienna, Austria-Hungary, which was the preeminent Balkans power at the time, collapsed into pieces, and all sorts of people who lived there established their own nation states. The South Slavs who lived in Austria, Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs, as well as the group that had converted to Islam in today's Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was at that point not classified as a nation, but today calls themselves Bosnian Muslims or Bosniaks, they had arranged for a sort of a popular assembly, maybe think of it as a Continental Congress, and decided to join the Kingdom of Serbia in a united state. But that was not akin to the Constitutional Convention here in the States, where you had, you know, 13 colonies with set boundaries and set political systems coming together and signing a treaty. No, there was no actual state that joined the Union. It was declared a state of Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs, but it didn't have borders, it didn't have government, it didn't have anything. Well, for the next 20 years, that country was ruled and became known as Yugoslavia under a Serbian king who unsuccessfully tried to push a sort of centralized government, French-type system onto the rest of the country, but it really didn't work too well. and was under constant attacks by all sorts of ethnic separatists, as well as the communists, who loathed the very idea of some sort of Yugoslav union, and especially Serbian monarchy. And so their program goal was to destroy Yugoslavia and create separate ethnic nation states. Now, World War II comes along, the Nazis invade, because they needed that particular strategic position for the attack on Greece and the attack on Soviet Union. And there's kind of a story in there that because of that invasion, they had to postpone the invasion of the Soviet Union, which got them bogged down in mud and snow and lost them the war. But sort of apocryphal, it could go either way, we don't know for sure. Anyway, they invaded and they divided Yugoslavia, just like the communists wanted them to. Except that soon thereafter the occupation, they started fighting the Soviets, and all of a sudden the communists had declared the Nazis their chief enemy and started an uprising. During the war, there were horrible, horrible massacres perpetrated, especially in Bosnia, by the Croatian Nazis, who had, there was a small group that had basically worked with Italians in order to come into power. Their ideology was very fascist, and they made a deal with Hitler in early 1941 to basically become a vassal state, officially independent, but not in practice. And as soon as they got into power, they started implementing this very, very simple, unsophisticated, brutal campaign of genocide aimed at Serbs and Jews, because they viewed Serbs, who are Orthodox Christians, as schismatics, infidels, dirty peasants, whatever. See, Croats and Slovenes are mostly Catholic, because they had spent most of their history in Roman Catholic West. Serbs, Macedonians, are generally Orthodox Christians. And because they had lived under Turkish occupation, Ottoman Turkish occupation, where ethnicity really didn't matter, everything was decided on the basis of a caste system built on religion, their faith became a crucial component of their identity. And to a similar extent, it was so in among the Croats and the Slovenes. So that was one of the big schisms between these people. And then, of course, you have the Bosnian Muslims in the mix, and Muslim pockets in Serbia, and, of course, the Albanians were a whole different thing altogether. And they are largely, of course, Muslim. And so you have really a religious dimension to the whole thing. And long story short, after World War II, the communists came out on top as the basically military and political force. The Croatian Nazis were defeated. They mostly escaped. The Serbian royalists were defeated, and they also were exiled. And the overwhelming power in the country, thanks to some 500,000 or 600,000 armed troops, were the communists, who proceeded to create a federation of republics, such as the Soviet Union was. But see, whereas in the United States, originally, all 13 states were independent, and they had joined a union of their own free will, in Yugoslavia, it was the other way around. The union, Yugoslavia, really did exist before the states, and the states that were created were completely arbitrary. And what the communists did, and this is amply documented in their papers, they wanted to offset the fact that there are about, let's say, out of 22 million people in Yugoslavia, there are about 10 million Serbs, and about 12 million everybody else put together. And they wanted to offset that numerical superiority because that would be a lopsided federation that would be ungovernable, especially since Serbs had an alternate political tradition as opposed to in comparison to communism that actually had existed independently for a while. So they divided Serbia into provinces, one of which was Kosovo, which they had proceeded to... they proceeded to encourage immigration of ethnic Albanians, who had been present in the territory but had not been a majority until mid-20th century. And they also drew boundary lines of Croatia and Bosnia to stretch all over the place and generally try to kind of redistrict the country to make the ethnic lines more palatable to control. And the real problem occurred when, after the collapse of communism and the arrival of the multi-party system, you had a situation in which every separate republic started acting like an independent state in absence of a federal government that would crack down on them, because federal governments in Yugoslavia was very, very, very weak ever since Tito's death. Tito was the communist leader who had led the resistance to the Nazis in World War II, and who broke infamously with Stalin in 1948 because he refused to obey orders from Moscow and had therefore been a sort of a hero to the West for quite some years.
And when did he die?
He died in 1980. He was about 82 or 83 years old, I think, at that point. So his last couple of years of his reign were, he wasn't all there. And he didn't appoint a successor either. He, after his death, because he never had any sort of will or any sort of arrangement, his close associates from the party, who were just about as old, set up this committee who tried to run the federal government. But unfortunately, Tito had created a country in which all of these components would be fighting against each other, and he would be sitting in the capital and telling everybody what to do as the final judge of their disputes. But when he died, you had this committee that was elected by the people who were supposed to be judged. And so obviously that committee had no power. And the situation was able to trundle along for about 10 years, just like in the Soviet Union. We thought, you know, the Soviet Union was all this big, strong, and powerful, and during the 80s, the truth is they were falling apart because they couldn't sustain themselves any longer. And there's a history of bad debts and horrible investments and communist mismanagement of the economy. I mean, there's all sorts of factors that contributed to this. But in essence, when in 1989 the Berlin Wall collapsed and this whole chain of events toppling communism in Eastern Europe started happening, in Yugoslavia, all these forces that had been active during World War II and before suddenly began to resurface because of unfinished business. Now, on one hand, you had the Serbs who finally realized after about 40 years and after a lot of incidents in Kosovo throughout the 1980s, which was at that point under, it was ruled by the ethnic Albanians, administered as an almost independent state. And Serbs and other non-Albanians living in the area were exposed to such persecution that basically the Serbian establishment, for the first time after 50 years, took a position contrary to the federal government and said, look, these guys are conducting ethnic cleansing. We're being chased out of Kosovo, which is of vital interest to Serbian culture because this is the cradle of Serbian state, Serbian civilization. This is where all the churches and monasteries and museums and monuments are. You know, this cannot go on. This cannot be allowed. And at that point, this communist apparatchik known as Slobodan Milosevic, he said, well, wouldn't it be nice if I could come into power promising to correct the communist policy of mismanagement by reintegrating Serbian provinces. And so he came to power in 1987 inside the party. I don't think he got elected president of Serbia until 1989. I could be wrong, though. I think it was the fall of 1989 when he initiated constitutional reforms in Serbia, which actually, by the way, were ratified by the parliaments in both Belgrade and the provinces, that essentially amended the constitution at the time, and that was like the fourth or fifth constitution because the communists were fond of changing those every couple of years, basically starting from scratch completely. You have to understand this. There's no consistency of constitution in Yugoslavia's case. They had five or six new constitutions since 1945. This is kind of hard to comprehend, but it's absolutely true. And at that point, they amended the constitution to take away from the provinces the authority that they got in 1974. That was the last rewrite of the constitution before Tito died, so that the government of Serbia could function. Now, as a libertarian, I would necessarily be against the function of government anywhere. But the way this operated in Serbia was basically divided one coherent state, to call it that way, into three sections. And two of these sections, the autonomous province of Vojvodina, which by the way means duchy, a realm ruled by a duke, and Kosovo were de facto independent states. And this was set up to appease the ethnic Albanian leadership in Kosovo, which by the, at the time had grown really strong in 1974. But even then, they demanded secession and complete independence and annexation to Albania. So you have a situation that throughout the 1980s, there was a federal military presence in Kosovo, a federal police presence, in order to crack down on the riots and guerrilla attacks and even terrorist attacks. And in 1989, the constitution has changed. And you have about a year and a half of peace in Yugoslavia as a whole at that point. But in Kosovo, you have a situation where this movement for Kosovo to be declared independent decides to withdraw completely from public life. And all these, and you have to understand, in a communist system, everything is state-owned, everything is government-owned, everything is public. You have public schools, public hospitals, public concert halls, public police, fire department, everything is public. And so with these people boycotting the government, they literally set up a parallel society, which, again, is a good idea in and of itself. I don't really mind. I don't think any libertarian really should. But they did this on the basis of ethnic apartheid. They claimed they were persecuted and fired from their jobs, but what happened is that they walked out and set up separate ethnic Albanian society and pseudo-government. They didn't want to get rid of government. They just wanted to get rid of Serb government. And this society only functioned amongst the Albanians. Nobody else was welcome in it. And this lasted until the events of 1998 and the whole Kalian Kosovo War, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. What happens in 1990 is, with the free elections all over Eastern Europe, there's great pressure for elections in Yugoslavia. And there's a series of elections in each of Yugoslavia's quote-unquote states where different parties win power. In Slovenia, it was former communists posing as independent liberals. Their goal was independence of Slovenia from the rest of Yugoslavia. They didn't want to pay taxes, which were oppressive, but they did want to have access to the rest of the market and the raw materials. See, they would buy raw materials from the rest of the country and then sell them back to finished products, and they objected to paying taxes on that. Croatia wanted to secede, and in Croatia, the organization that won the elections was called the Croatian Democratic Union, but in its ranks were many of the people who were either directly involved with the Nazi state of 1941 to 45, or their descendants, or people who were in that particular ideological spectrum. They were very nationalist, they were very anti-Serb, very anti-Semitic, too. And in fact, Croatia's first president, Franjo Tuđman, had famously written a book in which he denied the Holocaust, or tried to say, well, yeah, it did happen, but it was only a couple of 100,000, not 6 million. He campaigned for independence for about a year before he had finally declared secession. At that point, he had received enough weapons from various Eastern European sources and a lot of diplomatic help from German government. But at the point when the elections happened, it was pretty much a given that Yugoslavia was going to fall apart, because Slovenia wanted to go, Croatian government wanted to secede. The people who came in power in Bosnia, they were a coalition of ethnic parties. See, Bosnia had a... Stop me whenever you feel I'm rambling on for too long, because this is really a complex issue.
No, this is great. I love it. Go ahead.
In Bosnia, you had a situation where no ethnic group had a clear majority. You had about a third of the population who were ethnic Serbs, about 15% of the population, 15 to 17, who were ethnic Croats, and about 42 to 44% who had declared themselves as Muslims. They weren't ethnically or racially foreign to the Balkans. They were native Slavic people who had converted to Islam during the Ottoman rule, which had lasted about 400 years. And these people had formed their ethnic identity around their religion, which is kind of... In one aspect, it's kind of strange, because communism nominally discouraged religion, and certainly practicing Muslims were persecuted under communism. But at the same time, they tried to use that as a bedrock of creating a nationality, which just goes to show that generally for communists and socialists of all stripes, identity issues, religion, and freedom of expression really don't mean anything until, unless they can be used for political purposes. And in Serbia, of course, in spite of very strong opposition and very strong, I would say, nationalist parties that were formed in 1990, Milosevic, because of his hard line on Albanian claims in Kosovo and his effort to preserve Yugoslavia, he wanted to preserve Yugoslavia as a centralized federation, basically status quo that existed in 1990. He won that first election. He really did.
And that's when the war broke out then?
Well, the war didn't break out until early 1991, so there was about a 6 to 7 month period of peace, because the last election was in Serbia, and I believe in Macedonia, and that was November or December of 1990. But what happened is that in, I believe it was May or June of 1991, that Slovenia and Croatia declared independence. Now, if you take a look at the map of the Balkans, any map in any atlas of modern Balkans, the Balkans today, you will see that Croatia has most of the Adriatic coast and a large chunk of the plain, of the plains in the north. And there's this triangular chunk sandwiched between two of the two parts of Croatia, the north and the south, that is Bosnia. And you have a river, and then on the eastern side of the river is Serbia. Problem is, along the river that divides Croatia from Bosnia in the north, and largely along that southern border between Croatia and Bosnia, were substantial territories inhabited mostly, if not predominantly, by Serbs. Because, see, that river and that particular mountain border were the boundary between the Austrian Empire and the Ottoman Empire. And the Serbs, who had been pushed out of the Ottoman Empire as refugees, were settled by the Austrian Empire in that border region, along the border with the Turks. So when you look at the ethnic map today, or ethnic map in 1990, the pattern of Serb settlement, or the pattern of, you know, where Serbs were a majority, really doesn't make sense until you look at the map of Austrian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and you realize that they were settled along the border.
So this
and the Austrian, see these? Right, go ahead.
Well, this whole situation was basically just a tinderbox waiting to explode. You had the governments for 100 years relocating ethnic groups here and there,
mm-hmm.
and then when everybody tried to break away, half their populations were in the other states, right?
Precisely, and that was precisely the problem. This was the root of the Yugoslav crisis. People say it was an ethnic war. Not really. They say it was a religious war. No, not really. They say it was a war of aggression. That's bogus. What it really was a conflict between the desire of certain governments to... It was a war of secession and counter-secession. That's pretty much what it was. And I'm talking about the period between 1991 and 95. The Kosovo War of 99, that was a whole different situation that we'll get to in a little while if we have time. What happened with the whole situation in Croatia, Slovenia, and Bosnia is that Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, or the Muslim authorities in Bosnia, construed the decision by the European Union. There was a commission established by the European Union in 1990, whose goal was to determine judicially the solution to the Yugoslav crisis. They didn't really have any legitimate mandate to do this. They just kind of said, okay, you know, we're European Union, this is our sphere of influence, we can tell you what to do. And this commission, led by a French lawyer, reached a surprising conclusion that basically said, look, let's just cut through the red tape and say that provinces or republics or states or whatever you call them are going to be treated like independent states. You know, whatever boundaries are, administrative boundaries between these states, are going to be international borders now. Now imagine the chaos that would occur in the United States if you had boundaries of American states declared international boundaries. And in this country, that was once the case. They were actually international boundaries, at least out here out east. And in Yugoslavia, that was never the case. So all of a sudden, you have about 2.5 million Serbs, basically overnight by the declarations of independence in Bosnia and Croatia, from becoming... how shall I say? There's a category of constituent people as opposed to ethnic minorities. Constituent people have collective rights, self-determination, representation, and so on and so forth. It wasn't a one-man, one-vote, ethnically blind democracy by any stretch of imagination. It was very much a European collectivist type setup. So these 2 to 2.5 million Serbs overnight find themselves declared an ethnic minority without any rights, because ethnic majority has rights to public education, language, coats of arms, language, culture, and so forth. But minorities, you know, they get one public radio station and maybe a nod to their existence. And it's the Serbs especially who were specifically named as a nation in Croatia's constitution were written out of the constitution by the new government. Now you have to remember, World War II, Croatian Nazis perpetrate genocide against the Serbs that were in Croatian territory, these Serbs that had been settled there by the Austrians. So obviously these people have bad feelings, a lot of hard feelings. They were just the victims of genocide 50 years ago. So they're not going to stand for being part of some new Croatian state that not only is presided by an anti-Semite and an anti-Serb, but also is resurrecting the language and the symbols from that particular era. Imagine a neo-Nazi coming into power. I don't think many Jews would want to live in Germany of that sort. Of course, it's a rhetorical comparison. It's a rhetorical issue, but because there almost aren't any remaining Jews in Germany, but still, imagine there were, and, imagine that this would happen. So obviously, these 2.5 million people were royally peeved off. Now, in Slovenia, the situation was fairly simple. Slovenia was overwhelmingly ethnically Slovene. The federal government, who was at that time completely falling apart at the seams, tried to send federal troops to seize customs posts and, man the border, much like Lincoln did at Fort Sumter, and the Slovenians opened fire. And they ambushed a whole bunch of conscripts. I mean, the Yugoslav army at the time, and largely still, is a conscript army. It's not a professional service. They would basically, everybody at the age of 18 had to report to the local barracks for a year of military training. And so these kids, literally kids, they were sent up to Slovenia with orders not to shoot unless they're attacked. And in many cases, they were sent in there without ammunition, so they got slaughtered. So the federal government tries to declare martial law, and, that would give them the authority to actually start shooting at people. And at the session of the federal presidency, which is that committee that I mentioned before, the Serbs support this. There were 4 Serbs sitting up there. And they supported it, but the Croat, Slovenian, Macedonian, Bosnian representative, who was also ethnic Serb, but he voted according to the desires of the government in Sarajevo, they said, no, we don't want martial law. And so that fell through, and the federal government at that point was pretty much non-existent. They couldn't do anything. They had no power whatsoever. So an arrangement was made, mediated by the Europeans, to place a 6-month moratorium on the Declaration of Independence in exchange for a complete withdrawal of the Federal Army from Slovenia. And so at that point, Yugoslavia was pretty much gone, because one of its pieces of the puzzle had just practically succeeded in saying, screw you guys, we're leaving. Which created a problem in Croatia, because nobody opposed the right of the Croatian people. Especially, most Serbs honestly didn't mind Croatians seceding. The problem was Croatia, the borders.
Right, and taking a bunch of Serbs who lived there with them.
Precisely. And the same thing was to a similar extent happened in Bosnia. In Bosnia, as well as in administrative boundaries of Croatia, it was not Milosevic's political party. His party was the successor to the communists. It was called the Socialist Party. It was not Milosevic's party who won the vote of the Serbs. It was this organization that was set up by, nationalists. I think it would be fair to call them nationalists. They were definitely not communists. And called themselves the Serb Democratic Party. And in Croatia, it had several leaders. In Bosnia, its founding leader and president all the way until the end of the war was Radovan Karadzic, who is currently wanted by the so-called war crimes tribunal, which I've written extensively about, and I don't believe they have any sort of legitimacy. Not because of the crimes that happened or not, because there were a lot of atrocities, but because of the fact that they are blatantly illegal. There's all sorts of problems in its founding, but I digress. So the Serbs in Bosnia and Croatia had basically said, look, if you guys secede, if the Hermans in Zagreb and Sarajevo decide to secede from Yugoslavia, we're going to secede from Croatia and Bosnia, because it's our right. We're a constituent nation. We have a right to self-determination. We're going to secede. And, of course, the French Commission had completely arbitrarily and in defiance of international law ruled that it's not the people who have the right of self-determination, but the states, the republics.
Of course.
Right. So when it came to Bosnia, the Serbs really did secede. As soon as the Muslim leadership and the Croat leadership decided to back independence, the Serbs said, fine, you know, you do that and we'll secede. And March of 1992, right around the time when the United States actually recognized Croatia and Slovenia and Bosnia as independent states, there was a conference in Lisbon, I believe, at which the leaders of all three ethnic communities in Bosnia, basically chairman of the all three ethnic parties, because if you can imagine, political parties in Bosnia were formed along ethnic lines. You had the Croat party, the Serb party, and the Muslim party. It was ethnic democracy's worst nightmare. And in Lisbon, they had signed this agreement to basically subdivide Bosnia into three territorial provinces. Each of them would be highly autonomous. And, you know, the collective rights of that particular nation that had majority in there would be guaranteed. Well, Bosnia's, the president of Bosnia's governing committee, because see, Bosnia, like Yugoslavia, also had a governing committee, was a fellow named Alija Izetbegović, who died a couple of weeks back, who was a hardline Muslim fundamentalist with a couple of books to his credit and has been recognized for his contribution to Islam by Saudi Arabians, Malaysians, Iranians, Egyptians, you name any sort of authority in the Islamic world on the issues of interpretation of Islam, and they've recognized Izetbegović as a major Islamic scholar and statesman. He comes back to Bosnia after this conference, and he had signed this treaty, basically subdividing Bosnia, and then he comes back and says, look, I changed my mind. I'm declaring that signature null and void. We're proceeding with full independence. And, of course, there's war, because the Serbs get up in arms and refuse to take it. Now, let me go back a step and mention, because I forgot about this, it's kind of a hard thing to forget. In 1991, when Croatia declared independence, the Croatian Serbs declared their secession, declared the formation of their own state, and basically set up checkpoints at the borders of the territories they claimed as their own. Croatian military that was established largely in secret during the first half of that year launched an attack on them. There was some very, very bloody fighting. There was a lot of villages were burned, a lot of people were executed. There were some very gruesome crimes on both sides, because you had militias and regulars and all sorts of military formations, some of which were only interested in looting and pillaging and rape, not really in fighting for one side or another. There were mercenaries. It was really ugly. And you really, on a good day, didn't know who was shooting at whom. And in the midst of that was a disintegrating federal army, which, of course, when the Croatians stopped sending conscripts and Slovenians stopped sending conscripts and the Bosnian Muslims, because of their solidarity with the Croatians, stopped sending conscripts, most of the conscripts in the federal military were Serbs. And so these people, together with their officers who didn't know what the hell they were doing anymore, decided to support local Serbs. And those who stayed in Croatian-controlled territory, who stayed in their military bases, which were, as part of the communist doctrine, placed in the middle of cities, found themselves under siege because Croatians figured, okay, we'll force these federal troops to surrender, seize their weapons, and try to bargain them in prisoner exchanges. Croatia accused Serbia of aggression, but Serbia, as a state, never actually declared war. Nor did it send any of its own government troops into Croatia. That was strictly a federal matter. The federal government was disintegrating, but it was still theoretically functional until May of 92. And all the evidence points out that Serbia was actively supporting the Serbs in Croatia and Bosnia with money and weapons and even former army officers, including sending volunteers. But the actual Serbian military was never there. There was no Serbian military, for that matter. So this 6 months of intense fighting in Croatia, which resulted in a lot of people killed and a lot of refugees and a lot of really ugly things done all over the place, ended in the winter of 1991. And in early 1992, the treaty that was signed was basically that there will be a ceasefire. The UN troops are going to come in and they're going to position themselves along the front lines. These Serb areas were going to be demilitarized and declared UN protected areas. They were basically going to be UN protectorates. And the Federal Army would retreat, but the Federal Army was already pretty much gone by that point. I mean, not physically removed, but practically non-existent. And so in the spring of 1992, all these UN troops started coming in into Croatia, and they decided to make their headquarters in Bosnia because it was centrally located and it was close enough to all the belligerents and everything. Well, by the time they got there, Bosnia had, the Bosnian Muslims and their Croat allies had declared independence, and the Serbs had declared their independence. And all of a sudden, there was a war in Bosnia, and they were caught in the middle of it. So for the next 3.5 years, the UN mission in Bosnia started getting a more expanded mandate to, you know, deliver food, control the airspace, protect civilians, and so on and so forth. It was a very dubious mandate that didn't really, they weren't supposed to intervene. That was basically it. And for that, even though they had saved thousands of lives by delivering food to people who would have otherwise starved to death, they were seen as, on the Muslim side in particular, they were seen as, accessories, I suppose, to a great war crime of aggression, because they didn't join the war on the Muslim side. The whole politics of Izetbegovic's, the whole policy of Izetbegovic's government was, okay, we have 100,000 to 300,000 conscripts that we can arm with, you know, infantry weapons. We don't really have much in the way of armor or artillery. We have some, but not nearly enough to go toe-to-toe with the disintegrating Federal Army, and especially the Serbs, who had, you know, most of the Serbs from Bosnia when, in May of 1992, Milosevic declared the new Third Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which was only Serbia and Montenegro, those two states of the former Yugoslavia. At that point, all of the federal personnel that was born in Bosnia that were technically foreign citizens at this point were left in Bosnia, and all the Serbian-born officers and soldiers went back home. And incidentally or accidentally or very much on purpose, they left all their heavy weapons behind. Not all, but most. So you basically had a situation which the Serb army, the Bosnian Serb army, ended up with most of the federal military's weapons, because most of the federal soldiers at this point were Bosnian Serbs. And so, outgunned like this, but not necessarily outmanned, because he still had about three times as much men power than either Croats or Serbs, Izetbegovic decided that his only strategy would be to get an international intervention, basically to have NATO or the United States or Europe fight the war for him. And for 3.5 years, he tried exactly that. He did everything in his power, from propaganda to all sorts of stories and rumors and even targeted attacks that were designed to fail and produce gruesome casualties, in order to get the world's public opinion to back military intervention on his behalf. And eventually, after a fashion, he succeeded. He didn't get what he bargained for. Instead of a, you know, unitary Muslim-dominated Bosnia, which he wanted, he got an international protectorate occupied by 10,000 NATO troops, which was not what he wanted at all, but at least he did not have to sign away a peace and declare Bosnia non-existent. So at that point, in 1992, the situation just got completely nuts. the Serbs were shooting at Muslims, the Muslims and Croats were shooting at Serbs, Serbs were shooting at Croats, remnants of the Federal Army were shooting at whoever the hell they could shoot at, whoever the hell was shooting at them. And in May, when Serbia and Montenegro declared a new Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and by that very act recognized the independence of all the other republics, which was never properly explained or appreciated anyway, you had a situation in which Bosnia as a state was non-existent. You had the Bosnian Muslims who controlled maybe 15 to 20% of its territory. You had Croatians, Bosnian Croats, as well as Croatian regular troops who controlled about 10% of Bosnia. And you had the Serbs who controlled at any given time anywhere between 55 and 70%, most of which were territories where ethnic Serbs had a majority. Some territories, especially in eastern Bosnia and central Bosnia, were taken by military force as strategic. And throughout the war, minority populations, quote-unquote, these are Bosnia's constituent people, Serbs, Croats, and Muslims, who ended up in territories ruled by the other ethnic group, were inevitably exposed to persecution. Men were inevitably either conscripted or sent to prison camps or sent to labor battalions, because you can't just let, you know, able-bodied males run around and not make use of them. That goes completely against everything that any statist, especially people schooled in the communist school, thought, believed in. You know, people exist to serve the state, and you have an able-bodied male, he should be able to either carry a gun or carry a sack of flour or carry a crate of ammunition. So, there was a lot of what is called ethnic cleansing, but it was basically forcible expulsion of civilians, as well as, okay, we strongly suggest you to leave and not take any property with you. Otherwise, you'll be shot. They don't actually shoot anybody, or they shoot only a couple of people, but the rest of them pick up and leave. So it wasn't really voluntary. It was coercive. But people, by and large, were either expelled or fled to territories controlled by their own ethnic militias. And a lot of people have tried to present the Bosnian War as a war of aggression and genocide, but that is just complete nonsense. It was aggression against whom? I mean, you have three ethnic groups that are fighting for territory, and they have mutually exclusive claims. And, you know, Serbs want what they believe is theirs, Croats want a piece that they believe is theirs, and the Muslim leadership, and I'm not generalizing about all Muslims, mind you, but the leadership concentrating around Izetbegovic, they wanted everything. They denied everybody else the right to secede. So in that circumstance, any sort of peaceful solution was completely impossible. Because, you know, if you have three groups that want just a piece of land, then they can, you know, they can bargain between each other as to which pieces of land they can take. That would probably be fine. But if you have two groups that are interested in land and one group that is not interested in negotiating at all, then you have a problem. So about 3.5 years later, the Americans come in the persona of Richard Holbrooke. He shuttles between Serb, Croat, and Muslim leaders. He shuts out Bosnian Serbs from the whole loop. He goes directly to Milosevic in Belgrade and says, I choose to speak to you as the person in charge. We can either talk to you and you can try making a peace treaty here, or we can just intervene on behalf of the Muslims and just crush the Bosnian Serbs. Which he proceeded to do at that point by initiating a NATO bombing of the Bosnian Serb positions. This was August and September of 1995. Now, during the Bosnian War, there were a lot of, again, massacres of civilian population, as well as mass executions of prisoners of war. This was not a pretty war, which war is. And every side in the conflict regarded other ethnic group, whether civilian or militia, it doesn't matter. There are no civilians in civil wars. They regarded them as enemy combatants, and they were subject to imprisonment, beating, torture, plunder, especially plunder. They love to steal stuff. I mean, every militia in that region, not every soldier, but a lot of these armed formations, especially delighted in looting and destruction of houses and museums and churches and mosques and just everything that they could get at.
So when Holbrooke came in, did he take a bad situation and make it worse, or was it?
Yes, I would say so. Well, in a manner of speaking, I mean, what he did was he didn't take the situation, the real situation, and try to work on the basis of it. He basically said, no, this is what you may think is happening, but this is the way I choose to see it. And because of that, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to bomb these guys. I'm going to support these guys' ethnic cleansing, and I'm going to support these guys' land offensive, and they're allowed to cheat on a ceasefire, and so at the point where the strategic situation is good enough for what I want to do, I'm going to step in, declare a ceasefire, and force all three sides to sit down in a small air base in Ohio and keep America for 3 weeks in a small room until they agree to sign a peace treaty. On one hand, it worked. They did sign a peace treaty. But if you read Holbrooke's book, which I've reviewed in one of my previous articles, you can see that this happened despite the obstruction from Izetbegovic. He didn't want a peace. He wanted the entire Bosnia. He really did. And in the end, the Serbs and the Croats have made so many concessions to Izetbegovic's vision of the Bosnian government, but they insisted on preserving separate territories, that basically Holbrooke turned around and told Izetbegovic, look, you know, if you don't do this, I'm going to have to go, President Clinton's going to have to go on national television and say, you don't want peace. We don't want to do that. We support you. We're your friends. Work with us. And so Izetbegovic said, fine, you know, if I do this, will you train my military? And Holbrooke said, yes. So basically Izetbegovic's goal, and this is speculation at this point, because this never happened. It never happened. It never came to pass. But at this point, I believe that Izetbegovic's goal was to take the armistice, take the one-year, two-year ceasefire, build up his military, and then continue the war. But once the war stopped, and once those native troops came in, and once they didn't leave after 1 year, as Clinton had promised, gee, Clinton lied. What a surprise. There really was no way you could restart that type of war. Now, there's still a lot of very bitter sentiments in Bosnia on all sides, and there's still a lot of talk, especially in Muslim areas, of, you know, liberating the entire country and, you know, crushing the Serbian aggressor. But at this point, I don't think most people would be interested in another fight. They've lived through a very, very bloody war that was very brutal on all sides, and even the people who didn't experience the fighting per se, had suffered a lot in terms of, you know, their entire life savings being wiped out, they're having no food. It was really harsh on everybody, on some people more than others, but harsh all over the place.
So if the Americans got out now, or NATO and the UN and whoever, if all the international intervention pulled out now, the war wouldn't start right back up again?
Well, that's kind of that kind of calls for a prophecy, and I'm not particularly good with those.
I didn't really mean to phrase it like that. I guess the better way to phrase it is the American troops in between the warring parties are keeping them from fighting now?
Yes and no. At this point, they're not really so much positioned in between the warring parties as they're positioned all over the country to support the international administration by this entity called the High Representative, whose mandate comes from a group of six countries that had formed they call themselves the Contact Group, and they basically gave themselves the right to administer the peace in Bosnia. The U.S. is one of them. There's Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Russia, I believe.
So this is basically like the de facto federal government for the whole former Yugoslavia, then?
No. This is right. This is the federal. This is the international protectorate over Bosnia. Bosnia has 15 governments. See, there's the Bosnian Serb government, which runs half the country, which is the territory they got at the Dayton Peace Talks. And then there's these Bosnian Muslim and Croat Federation, which runs the other half of the country. And that federation has, I believe, last time I checked, it was 10 provinces. And each one of those has a president and a vice president and a parliament and a government and a judiciary. I mean, these are, this is basically, Bonkin's idea of decentralization is taking all the government powers and recreating them on a local level. So you basically have 10 governments in the Bosnian Muslim Croat Federation, one government in the Serbian Republic, and which is different than the Republic of Serbia, we have to make that distinction. And then you have the joint government in Sarajevo that is composed of Serb, Croat, and Muslim delegates, much like it was before the war. So in effect, you have, what, 12, 13 governments? It's insane. I mean, this, you know, Bosnia has the highest number of government bureaucrats per capita in the world.
Wow, even more than the United States?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Hard as it may be to imagine, but we're talking, yeah, we're talking basically half the country is dedicated to bureaucracy, which is why Bosnia is economically destitute. They can't afford to pay for all this.
Yeah,
not to mention the... It is a mess. It is a horrible mess.
I got to say one thing here real quick. We're almost out of time. We got about 7 minutes left.
Oh, dear.
And then, I know, I wish I could do this for 2 hours. I got a whole other hour worth of questions for you, but I got another interview with Karen Kwiatkowski coming up next hour, so...
Okay, well, good luck with that. I love Karen's writing.
Yeah, I do too. I'm hoping it's going to be as good as this one has been so far. Let's jump ahead a little bit and explain the Kosovo thing. I'm really confused. The best I understand, and this is a very sketchy understanding, but the Kosovo Liberation Army is, you know, basically hand-in-hand with Al-Qaeda, right? And we took their side?
Yes. In a nutshell, yes. They got support from Al-Qaeda, and they certainly are a terrorist organization, without a doubt. They were even classified as such by the State Department at one point, and one of the ambassadors who was serving at the time called them an undoubtedly terrorist organization. Problem is, this organization was financed by the United States, and I think at one point the German Secret Service as well, as a way of destabilizing Milosevic's Serbia. Because the policy of the U.S. after Dayton was Slobodan Milosevic runs Serbia. He is an enemy of American interests. We have to get him out by any means necessary. And so the Kosovo War was an attempt to get Milosevic out of office. It failed. They had to basically spend $25 million and train about 5,000 people in Serbia to basically stage a coup after the election of 2000 and take over power. And these are the people who are running Serbia to the ground right now and who have not a shred of moral integrity. I'm not saying Milosevic's government was a paragon of goodness. Far, far be it from it. They were socialists, and I honestly don't like socialists that much. But they at least tried to do something that they thought was in the interest of the country. These guys are running the place into the ground. What happened in Kosovo was in 1998... one of the Albanian clans, because they're society organized around clans and tribes, they had formed a guerrilla group to fight for Kosovo's independence, and their primary targets were post offices, police stations, bars, churches, kids playing. Their aim was just to spread terror around the population and provoke a police response. When that did happen, they were almost wiped out. They were almost roundly defeated by the fall of 1998. This is where the United States steps in. Holbrooke again goes there and basically tells Milosevic, look, if you don't stop your military action in your own country, we're going to bomb you. And he says, fine, can you send if you want to send observers, make sure that these guys don't come back. And the observers are sent there. They're led by U.S. military intelligence people. They sit there, they observe the movements of the Yugoslav military, they give equipment and intelligence to the KLA, and they completely turn a blind eye when the KLA rolls back in. And in January of 1999, there's this stage massacre in a village in Kosovo that all the reports about it that had been suppressed and came out 2-3 years later say that there's no evidence this was a massacre. There's no evidence these people were even civilians. And yet, the leader of the mission, an American military intelligence person and the former ambassador to El Salvador during the 80s, he declares this, within 15 minutes, declares this a Serbian army massacre, a crime against humanity, and this is obviously a genocidal war, and we have to come in and bomb. And so there's this ultimatum to the Serbian government called the Rambouillet Agreement, which basically said, you give us the right to occupy Kosovo, and by the way, you give free passage and complete immunity to any NATO troops traversing anywhere in your country.
Right, I remember this. This was the offer that he couldn't possibly accept.
Exactly. And nobody could possibly accept this offer. I mean, try to go anywhere.
I remember on TV, they said, well, you know, we held this peace conference and the Serbs didn't even show up.
No, they showed up. They just refused to sign it because no self-respecting person anywhere could sign this kind of paper. And the Albanians refused to sign it initially because they thought, well, hey, I don't want to sign a peace treaty. I want you guys to bomb the Serbs. And they didn't sign it. And Madeleine Albright said, look, what are you guys doing? You're ruining everything. You're supposed to sign. The Serbs are not supposed to sign. And then we're supposed to use this as a pretext for bombing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so what happens is in March of 99... U.S., basically, NATO, but basically most of the planes that did this were U.S. planes. They started a 78-day bombing using anything from depleted uranium rounds to B-52s and even those B-2 bombers, the stealth bombers that take out of Missouri, that take off from Missouri and they're supposed to carry nuclear warheads. They use everything in Serbia. They pulverize bridges, they kill civilians in buses, they bomb marketplaces, hospitals, passenger trains. And at the end of it, Milosevic, based on an agreement that the Russians offered, which was immediately violated by NATO and the KLA, says, look, I'm going to withdraw my troops, government troops from Kosovo, but in exchange, these peacekeepers that you send in will have to protect the lives and property of everybody. And NATO said, ah, sure, okay, fine. And then they walk in, and the KLA walks in behind them. And the KLA expels 250,000 people, burns half the province, destroys over 120 churches alone, not counting monuments and other, you know, private property, and they institute a reign of terror against anybody who's not an Albanian, and even Albanians who refuse to recognize their authority. And here you have 60,000 NATO troops who just sit there and do absolutely nothing to stop any of it.
And these are the same people who are trying to provoke uprisings in Macedonia.
Yes, exactly. Right after Kosovo was, quote-unquote, liberated, these people crossed over into Macedonia and started a rebellion there. And then they crossed into inner Serbia, right across the border with Kosovo, and started a rebellion there, too. So obviously this is not about liberation, this is about territory.
I'm sorry, Mr. Malik, this interview is not over, except that we are just out of time.
Well, I'm sorry, Philip, but thank you very much.
This has really been great. Hope I can have you on again sometime to help flesh out some of this. This has been very compelling, very interesting.
Thank you. I'd be delighted to. Just do stop me when I start rambling.
I like the rambling. I learned a whole lot that I didn't know before. Everybody, you can read what Nebojša Malik writes at antiwar.com. It's the Balkan Express. And do you write anything else anywhere else, or...?
That's my primary column. I've written a few pieces here and there, but that's basically where I publish, yes.
Okay, great. That's antiwar.com. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, Mr. Malik.
Thank you, Philip. You have a nice day.
You too.